Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for joining in our meetings at a time of pandemic, which makes it possible for people outside of Sydney to join us, but we'll get back to live meetings as well no later than next year. But today we've got Fred Paul on the occasion of the publication of Die Laughing, the biography of Bill Leake, which has recently come out. So Fred will be known to many of you. He comments on Sky News on many things, including sharks, I think, is the main topic there. But he's been a journalist for 30 years. He first met Bill Leake when they were working together at The Australian. And currently, Fred, when he's not writing books on Bill Leake, is a producer at Sky News. So, Fred, over to you on the topic of remembering Bill Leake, and many thanks.
Thanks, Jared, and thanks, everyone, for having me. I see a few familiar faces in the audience, so g'day to all of you too. Just to start with, I'd like to point out that I feel very lucky to have been chosen as Bill's biographer, but I do feel like I was in a very unique position to do the job. Bill knew a lot of good writers, fantastic writers, and there's probably half a dozen people who were qualified to do the job. I arrived in Sydney in 1992 and met Bill in 94, at which point I didn't know a lot of people. And Bill was sober at the time, and his young kids were, you know, early teens. And to spend time with them, he was reacquainting himself with the sport of surfing, with which his kids were pretty obsessed about as well. And the four of us became a little kind of surfing group, and we actually wound up going all the way to Indonesia together on a pretty special trip to a very remote part of the archipelago, and found some amazing waves. Soon after that, I had some kids of my own, and Bill left his first wife, Astrid, and reacquainted himself with alcohol and kind of gave up surfing. And so my friendship with Bill remained then, but I quite luckily, in hindsight, became a bit of a spectator at that point. A lot of his friends who were very close to him then were all part of that, the hard drinking rabble, which I describe and investigate quite a lot in the book. But their memories of Bill from that period are kind of tainted by the fact that, in hindsight, they really all were quite pretty much destroying their lives. A lot of them wound up with broken marriages and, you know, in therapy and broke and so on. But one of the things about Bill during that time, being such an incredibly funny bloke and exuberant, he actually made alcoholism look like a pretty good idea. So he wore it well, even though he was kind of, his life was disappearing down a bit of a gurgler at the time. But there was never a dull moment with Bill. The problem with writing a biography of a person like Bill was he did live a hell of a lot in his short 61 years. He was a regular finalist in the Archibald. He painted a lot of important portraits, including two of Sir Donald Bradman. He was an excellent newspaper illustrator and, of course, probably Australia's greatest, finest cartoonist. He was a raconteur and an excellent writer. So, and on top of all that, some people here tonight might be familiar with this. Bill had an extraordinary gift for friendship. He really, really did value his friends. He was brought up Christian and became quite a devout atheist, if that's the right way of putting it, later in life. And he, throughout his life, he adhered to just two things. One was the truth and the other was to friendship. And he was very good at it. So, you know, to return to my original point, I do feel very privileged to have written this book. It was done with the cooperation of the family. And as such, I got a lot of really good insight into Bill's life before I met him in 94. And as you'll hear in a minute, his formative years were significant in as much as he developed values and kind of belief systems that remained remarkably consistent throughout his life. So I'll just go back to the most accessible of those formative years. I did go through, right, his childhood and his teenage years and high school, and they were all a bit of sort of raucous fun. But in 1978, when he was 22, he flew to Europe ostensibly to study the great masters at the great European art galleries. Bill had studied at the Julian Ashton Art School and at another art school in the Rocks in Sydney that was that emulated Matisse. He did that because he just wanted to broaden his experience with art as much as he could. But Julian Ashton taught him the two main things that any great artist needs, that is observation and draftsmanship. And having pretty much not mastered that, but acquired a decent command of those two aspects of art, off he went to Europe to see what, in his words, read the great masters. He didn't think that people could be taught great art. He just thought you could absorb it through seeing it. So off he went, and I was given access to the letters that he wrote to his family from this trip. And there's literally hundreds of them. And there are some interesting little nuggets in amongst them. In 1978, he wrote a letter to his sister Lynn, and he describes how stunned he was by the work of people like George Braque and Picasso and Rembrandt, Delacroix, Cezanne, and a few others. But in this same letter, he says, and I quote, "The glorious traditions of European culture don't only enrich the lives of the people, they also weigh them down. So much," and you'll have to pardon Bill's language here, "so much bullshit goes on in the holy name of tradition and politeness." So Bill, that was Bill's first profound observation of European culture, was that he found it restrictive. You know, he grew up in a very libertarian kind of Australia in the 60s and 70s. He went on, and I quote again, "I think that one of the great strengths of Australia is expressed in the way people say, oh, bullshit to everything. As long as people keep recognizing and condemning bullshit over there, everything will be all right." It's kind of remarkable to look at that now and look at what happened to Bill later in life. And it seems, in my opinion, to coincide with the moment in time when Australia stopped saying or recognizing or calling out bullshit when we saw it. Bill continued to call it out, and he got in enormous trouble later in life, which I'll get to eventually. But this also points out, this quote, when I read it, I was so startled when I read it, because it illustrates just how consistent Bill was. You know, despite how it appeared to his detractors, Bill never altered his values, nor did he ever stop calling out bullshit whenever or wherever he saw it. His fundamental values remained the same throughout life, and I hope I've managed to capture that in this book, because it, you know, people who knew Bill would recognize that there was a strength of character in Bill. He did have a lot of demons, and he suffered from depression, and in some, you know, darker moments suffered from serious self-doubt. But his values just, you know, as I said, remained utterly consistent. So when he had joined the Australian in 1994, he was, as anyone familiar with Sydney at the time will know, he was part of the lefty libertarian arts establishment. You know, he was still sucking up to the right people to try to win the Archibald. And he had spent a few years at Fairfax, kind of absorbing that lefty culture at Fairfax. And when he arrived at the Australian, I rang Paul Kelly and Chris Mitchell, who were the two people who hired him at the Australian. And I asked Paul Kelly what the Australian stood for at the time. And off the top of his head, it's one of the most remarkable quotes in the book. Off the top of his head, Paul listed about 15 or 20 things that the Australian stood for at the time. They were, you know, Aboriginal prosperity and reconciliation, the Republic, a nation of states, Australia's role in the world, Australian, you know, the encouragement of a unique Australian culture and so on. And then we segued the conversation into how Bill fitted into that. And I said, look, you know, Bill in those days, he was quite a lefty. And Paul said, actually, he wasn't, which really surprised me because, you know, I knew Bill soon after that. And he was quite left, but what Paul was actually saying was that he recognised that Bill would eventually and quite soon develop into a very much a free thinker. And the key quote, I'll have to paraphrase it from memory, but the key quote was that Bill just wanted to call out the frauds, and that's what he did. But what the other thing that Bill adhered to in his cartooning career was that the first rule of any cartoon is that it has to be funny first and make a point second. Bill was often making, you know, pretty overt political points in his cartoons, but he was also being just, you know, if he found something funny, then that was it. You know, whichever side of the political divide it fell on, he was happy with that as long as it was funny. So I'll ask Nick to put up this a cartoon now. It's of John Howard against against the assembled forces of republicanism in Australia. Bill did not like Mr. Howard. That's no secret. But I really, really like this cartoon. One of the great things about Bill's cartoons is that he tried under any circumstances to minimise the words he used. You know, if you look at someone like Kathy Wilcox or Lunig, for that matter, they tend to think of themselves as writers as well as cartoonists. But Bill, because he was also an artist, he tried to keep words right out of it. And this cartoon, I think, is just so charming. And Bill is grudgingly giving Mr. Howard enormous credit for having checkmated the entire Republican movement led by a perplexed and obviously frustrated Malcolm Turnbull. The other thing about this cartoon is that you couldn't caricature Howard as well, and you couldn't illustrate the energy and confusion of the Republican movement if you weren't first and foremost an artist. Especially towards the end, Bill's cartoons were actually quite seriously works of art, in my opinion. So I just thought I'd bring that one up as proof that that Bill had strong political opinions, but he didn't let his opinions always get in the way of a good joke. So it is well known that Bill despised Howard during this time, but it's a reflection of his character that he conceded on this occasion that Howard had played a masterful game. But Bill's disapproval of Howard became much more obvious earlier that year when he drew a cartoon of Howard preparing to bash three unfortunate Indigenous gentlemen for daring to stand up for various social and legal rights. I'll ask Nick to put that one up as well. This one was quite controversial. The original version of it was actually even more offensive. Bill drew a more offensive version and this one and took them to editor-in-chief David Armstrong, and he said, "Oh well, I'll just take the less offensive of the two." It was a standard strategy or technique of Bill's to do that, knowing that if he'd just taken this one along by itself, with no sort of more offensive relative cartoon to gauge it against, he probably wouldn't have got that one through either. So he did get that through, and Mr. Howard was deeply offended by it. And David Armstrong, the editor-in-chief, was given a serious dressing down at Parliament House soon afterwards. And that year also, Bill got into a lot of trouble for a cartoon, which I can't put up and I can't even describe because it was so offensive. It was Mr. Howard and Bill Clinton in Il Flagrante, I think they call it. I couldn't put it up because it's both vulgar and defamatory. But I spoke to Dennis Shanahan. That cartoon that Bill did, it was just as a joke to amuse a couple of friends, which wound up being widely circulated in Canberra while Bill was in Canberra at one stage. And it wound up landing on Mr. Howard's desk. And Dennis Shanahan was appointed the job of mopping this mess up. Bill had actually caused some serious offence to some high-ranking people. And Dennis told me that Mr. Howard, if he wanted, could have got Bill sacked over that cartoon, but he never did. Which is a fine reflection on Mr. Howard's character as well. Dennis told me, many other journalists would concur, that Mr. Howard has never felt that politicians should be offended by what they see or read in newspapers because it's all part of the game. In fact, Mr. Howard said that if they do get offended by it, they should seek another profession. So one of the interesting subplots of the book is that in the late 90s, Bill at one stage made a very charmingly but grudgingly complimentary cartoon of Mr. Howard, but on two other occasions that same year, drew cartoons that deeply offended him. But later in the book, in about 2014, the two men had somewhat of a rapprochement. Bill wasn't around for me to get his side of it. And as many of you would know, Mr. Howard doesn't betray private conversations, but he did confirm to me that they had a conversation at the 50th anniversary of the Australian newspaper. And Bill approached Mr. Howard, and there was something of a... after which something of quite an interesting relationship developed between them. And Bill would later go on to describe Mr. Howard as a great man, again, that brings me back to Bill's values. Bill, one of the things that that people misunderstand about Bill is that he switched political sides. This is the other advantage I have as his biographer. Working in the media, working in journalism during the 80s and 90s and even early 2000s, it was difficult not to be a lefty. I mean, all newsrooms in the country, and increasingly they still are inhabited by left-wing people. And sometime towards the end of the 2000s, I started to... I never was a sort of fundamentalist lefty as much as Bill was throughout a lot of our friendship. But we made a conscious transition pretty much at the same time, and we talked about it a lot, about how we had discovered that being libertarians, essentially that's what attracted us to being to left-wing politics, being libertarians, we realized that the most censorious people in the country were on the left, and the people defending the values that we consciously or unconsciously had aligned with were all on the conservative side of politics. So that's where we wound up. Bill never apologized for switching sides, and he lost a lot of friends for it. And neither did he ever apologize for telling the truth. I just want to segue into Bill's supposed racism now, and perhaps ask Nick to put up another cartoon. This is of an unfortunate scenario involving a man about to bash an Aboriginal woman. This is from 2003. And it's in reference to a speech that Warren Mundine delivered to the Labor Party when he ascended sometime around the time he was president of the party. And he said that the party had become too touchy-feely about Aboriginal issues. And Bill saw the words touchy-feely and took them off on a rather grim tangent. Now, the thing about this cartoon is that if you published that today, you would be in enormous trouble. But this was in the early days, if not preceding social media, Facebook and Twitter, so he was able to get away with it. It was only mildly controversial, but then Bill got into, you know, fast forward 13 years and we get to Bill's most famous cartoon, and what I'd suggest is probably the most famous cartoon in Australian history. The previously most famous cartoon in Australian history was Stan Cross's, you're probably familiar with it, Stan Cross's For Gore's Sake, Stop Laughing, two blokes hanging off after an accident on a high-rise building, about to hanging for grim life, which was a fine reflection of Australia's kind of fatalistic sense of humour at the time. Now, I think, as the most prominent cartoon in Australian history, that's been replaced by something that's not quite as funny. I think it's okay to say in polite company, there is something funny about this, but not something that you would make, that you would laugh out loud. Ineptitude and stupidity and idiocy are always funny in one way or another. I'm referring now to Righto What's His Name Then, if Nick can put that up. But it is incredibly grim. I mean, where Stan Cross, the grimness in Stan Cross's cartoon was that these guys might find themselves in a few seconds splattered on the pavement for being careless. The grimness in Bill's cartoon is there's nothing careless in the child's predicament. It all comes back to the delinquent dad's delinquency, I should say. So I won't bother analysing the cartoon because I imagine most of you know it quite well and have followed the debate about it and followed it all the way through the Human Rights Commission and so on. What I'd like to point out is that I approach this book with the habit of a journalist. With many of the habits of a journalist, I did it as even-handedly as I could. I've included a lot of Bill's flaws in the book. A lot of people have commented on that to me, that, you know, that it is a warts and all book, and I was guided by my knowledge of Bill, that if he could see the book, he would approve of what he put in it, but what I've put in it, I should say. But what What I haven't included in the book, and I hope readers can read between the lines, is just how angry I got at times while writing this, because Bill was not a racist person. He was by far, and I'm not exaggerating this, he was by far the most egalitarian person I have ever met. And he was raised in a household that utterly despised any form of bigotry. He passed the same thing on to his own children, and he lived his own life according to that ethos that you judge people by the content of their character, not the color of their skin or their sexual preference or whatever. And it still makes me angry. It still makes me furious. And that's reflected in the fact that I'm talking to you tonight and am yet to talk to anyone at the ABC, despite the fact that ABC, I've sent 6 copies of the book to various people at the ABC. Many people from the ABC, prominent presenters, mentioned very favorably in the book. But still haven't received a single call, and probably never will, because as far as the ABC and Australia's woke establishment are concerned, Bill is and will continue to be a racist conservative person, and is not deserving of their ABC's time. So I think on that I'll leave you to. I've had 26 minutes now, so I think I'll leave on that point. It's an honour to be speaking to you, and I'll open it up for questions.
Well, thank you very much, Fred. As we all know, you're here on the occasion of Die Laughing, the biography of Bill Leak by Fred Paul, and Fred's come in the office and signed copies. So Anne will be sending out a note tomorrow about how you can purchase a copy, and I'm sure that I'm not sure you'll get on the ABC, but I'm sure you'll get a big run on the Sydney Institute website, which is quite substantial. So now we go to questions and discussion. We've got plenty of time. We'll finish no later than the top of the hour. Thanks very much for a very informative and entertaining and account of Bill Leak. But just tell us, you hinted a bit about his household. Just tell us a bit about where he grew up, how he grew up. I think he's born, the mid-1950s? Just paint a bit of that kind of picture for us. I mean, how this guy ends up one of Australia's leading artists and cartoonists. Where does it all start?
It starts in Garoque in rural Victoria, not far from Japara, if I'm not mistaken, which Sydney Institute members will know. His parents were from Adelaide. He was born in Adelaide, and at 6 months he moved to Garoque, and then a couple of years later they moved to Condobolin in New South Wales. The family was Methodist, and his dad Reg was an absolute joker, a classic Australian sort of knockabout bloke. His mum was a classical pianist and a piano teacher. His elder sister, Lynn, auditioned for the conservatorium when she was 10 years old, and she got the gig. She managed to, 12 years old, I should say, and she was accepted into the conservatorium. So the family moved to Sydney, and that was the dramatic thing. I think, Bill would have been quite a different bloke if he'd grown up in the country, but in the city he was exposed to the sort of the arts and sort of culture that he always appreciated. One of his earliest influences was a Jewish European classical piano teacher who Bill adored, and he gave Bill a pretty good insight into European culture, and that's what sort of planted the seed for Bill where he wound up living in Europe for 4 years. His family were just ordinary middle class. I mean, anyone who met Bill would swear he grew up in a really rough working class family. Bill kind of put on the working class thing, but because he was solidly working class, he came from Beacon Hill, went to Beacon Hill High. Both his siblings went to the conservatorium. You know, literature and music, classical music, were constant features of his upbringing. And as soon as he was old enough, he was off to Europe to learn all about art. So, he had a standard middle class upbringing, but he yearned to know as much as he could about art. One of his most formative moments, he told me once, was seeing a Picasso for the first time at the Art Gallery of New South Wales. I think he was aged about 21 at the time, and that changed a lot for him. So. Pretty standard upbringing, but with a deep appreciation of art. And when he segued from art, he came back to Australia in 1982, having married a German woman, Astrid, had their first baby, and they came back as a young family to Sydney. He had one solo art exhibition and didn't make much out of it. So. He segued into newspaper illustration and cartooning, and that's where that was much to Australia's benefit. I think he contributed much more to the country as a cartoonist than he ever would have as an artist.
I'll just remind everyone, if you want to ask a question, just press the hand function or wave at the camera, and we've got plenty of time. So we'll come to Ross in a minute. Just tell us, you mentioned about he ends up predominantly as a newspaper illustrator, a cartoonist, but he was a very fine painter.
Yeah.
So do you think there was any conflict between one and the other? Why did he end up there? Why did he, was it us more money there, more employment,
yes,
more notice? What was that all about?
Well, when I met him in 1994, he was halfway through that transition. He was already a successful newspaper illustrator and cartoonist, and he'd been poached by The Australian. So that's, you know, that's a significant career right there. But he was still obsessed with the Archibald, and not winning the Archibald caused him so much distress that he actually had a breakdown, which I've looked into in the book. But his relationship with the Archibald is interesting, and it's interesting that you say, you know, which way was he heading at the time, because his first few entries in the Archibald were quite strictly realist paintings in the sort of European tradition. There's nothing gimmicky about them, which is why they never won the Archibald. But starting with his portrait of Graham Richardson in, I think, 1996, he started to introduce caricature to his portraits. And I think at first he probably thought that because he'd become such an excellent caricaturist, he probably thought that this would give him some sort of unique advantage at the Archibald. But that's not the kind of, the Archibald judges are always looking for some sort of gimmick, but that's not the gimmick they're looking for, because it comes from the mainstream media. And to win the Archibald, you have to be, you know, some sort of idiosyncratic, unique artist, you know, pursuing one particular style or another, especially if some sort of victim or identity politics is involved. And Bill kept that up for a while. I mean, he did a wonderful caricature of Sir Les Patterson and so on. But then towards the end, his last one was of his friend Paul Le Pettit, who was a writer for the Sunday Telegraph. And at the end of that, and that was probably in the mid-2000s, I think maybe 2007, his final entry to the Archibald was very similar to his very first ones. So he kind of came full circle and realized that he was never going to win the Archibald. His love of art never waned, and he could talk about art, you know, so eloquently. His earliest love was of Picasso, but Velázquez and Goya were two of his heroes as well. And you can see classical references in his cartoons. There's a great one of Gough, Whitlam meeting God, and God's reaching his hand out to say g'day, and Gough holds his hand out too, and their two hands are almost meeting, as just as God and Adam are in the Sistine Chapel. Bill loved doing that sort of thing. So, yeah, but once he decided on cartooning, Jared, he was quite resolute. It also coincided with him getting back on the drink. So it was an easier occupation when you've got a skin full.
We're going to go to Ross, although Ross's light's gone off. Are you there, Ross?
Can you hear me?
Yep.
Good to hear you, Fred. Thanks, you're right about Bill going to Alcoholics Anonymous.
I do, and thank you for your help with that. There's a very funny anecdote about AA, which I won't spoil it here because I'll probably tell it better in the book than I would by paraphrasing it. But Bill had a kind of a two-sided relationship with Alcoholics Anonymous. It seems he secretly attended while telling all his friends that he despised it. Bill tried everything. Bill did try.
Ross, let Fred finish and we'll come back to you.
I got to say, Bill did try everything to quit alcohol. Ross is very good at explaining, you know, the various psychological strategies when it comes to alcoholism. But Bill's overall relationship with alcohol was that he was so robust, he was so indestructible that he just saw it as proof. He saw it as proof that he was indestructible. That's probably what I'm trying to say. He would always get up and, you know, with a hangover and you know, twist the first one off for breakfast. I used to live in the same apartment block as Bill when he was at his worst. And he came to my place once. He used to come down most afternoons for a drink. And I had little infant children at the time. And he'd pop in for a couple and then go off on some crazy inebriated adventure. But he popped in one day and he looked absolutely terrible. He had caught some sort of virus. He had the flu. And he looked like he should have been in bed. He was gray. His voice was croaky and he was just awful. He really shouldn't have been up. And I said, "Oh, g'day, mate. How are you going?" "Oh, I'm a bit sick, mate." And "Oh, so, well, you know, you won't be having a beer then." And he goes, "Mate, I said I was sick. I didn't say I was dead."
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah.
So that you know what I'm talking about, Ross. That's the kind of alcoholic he was.
Okay, Ross, we've got time for one quick response and then back to Fred and then on we go. Ross?
Yes, he said to me, you know, when he fell off the balcony at Singo's place, it was lucky that he was pissed because he wouldn't have hurt himself as much. To which I said, if you hadn't been pissed, you wouldn't have fallen.
yeah, exactly. But like I said earlier, there were times when I thought he made alcoholism look like a good idea. I mean, he really did enjoy it. You pay the price for these things in the end. So, you know, and he certainly did. I mean, I saw him through some serious depression and as all of his friends did. He suffered from horrible, horrible demons. And he contemplated suicide often. You know, I don't go into great detail about that in the book because it's kind of implicit anyway. But he always said, you know, oh, then 2 days later, I'd be, oh, geez, I'm glad I didn't because isn't life great, you know? So, yeah.
Okay, we go to Harold, then we go to Anne. So, Harold?
Good on you, Fred. What a great subject you've chosen. I met him a few times, just a wonderful person. I never knew how well he could write till I read that article he wrote on how the left wing had taken over humour and really almost taken it out of our lives. The question it was under that wonderful cartoon he did of the patient being rushed into the department of hurt feelings department.
Yeah, man hit by cartoon. Yeah.
Yes. But I have a good friend who lives in Hardy's Bay.
Mm.
And he told me how Bill had moved there when he had a fatwa on him, got to know him very well. Can you expand on what happened there? And I understand he was very worried and that he was being looked after by Osho or somebody. Do you know much about that?
Yes, yes. So there's a guy who worked at the Australian at the time called Paul Maley, and he was investigating the Australians who had gone off to Syria to fight for ISIS. And this was a major story at the time. And Paul was really familiar with all the major players at the time, both overseas and in Australia, in the sort of jihadi scene. And there was chatter online in various social media platforms that someone needed to kill Bill for the crime of drawing a picture of the Prophet Muhammad. Bill had done that 2 or 3 days after the attack on Charlie Hebdo. Bill didn't know anyone at Charlie Hebdo, didn't have any relationship with the magazine at all, except for the fact that they were fellow libertarian cartoonists. And when that attack happened, his wife Gung came home and found him in tears. He was that upset by it. And instead of being defeatist about it, he went, right, well, we've got to join this fight. So he published a cartoon of the Prophet Muhammad. The chatter became audible online about about Bill, a fatwa against Bill. Paul Maley and the federal police confirmed that the threats were legitimate. And Bill... Bill was advised to sell his house and move to a secret location, which is what he did. People were under instructions when they went to Bill's new house not to take photos because you might accidentally later load them up on Facebook and the metadata on the picture could locate where the photo was taken. There's some funny sort of anecdotes around that. Because Bill illegally acquired himself a very low caliber revolver pistol, and answered the door with it in his pocket once, and he carried dumbbells around whenever he answered the door and that sort of stuff. He was seriously affected by this. But Harold, to the short answer to your question was, these were extremely legitimate threats. Bill wasn't the only one. Paul Maley was another. They had to reinforce the building at Holt Street, the News Corp headquarters at Holt Street, as well as all the other buildings around News Corp buildings around Australia. So the thing is, the other aspect, the unique aspect to this, Harold, is that I don't know what that would be like. I can imagine it would be enormously upsetting and frightening. I mean, Bill had an 11-year-old stepdaughter at the time. Wow. A new wife, a stepdaughter. They've had to move to a secret location with alarms all over the house that go straight to the federal police. And there was one room that was doubly secured where they could retreat to in the case of an attack. And Bill's office was on the ground floor, and it was behind two other buildings. And the driveway to his place went between those two buildings, and Bill could keep an eye on the driveway while he was at work. That was the plan. So if there was an attack, he had a couple of seconds notice. That's how serious it was. But the unique thing about Bill in this time of his life was that he was also, I just can't imagine how traumatizing that alone would be. But add to that that Bill at the same time was losing a lot of his old friends. His old leftist friends were writing him off as a brain-damaged, ex-alcoholic, newborn conservative and, consorting with the likes of John Howard. So I remember Bill in those years, he was quite, he was really staunch, and he was occasionally depressed, but... Geez, his strength during those years is just almost unbelievably superhuman. He kept it together, and he kept being funny. That's the thing. How can you be funny in those situations?
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah, incredible. Oh, so, well, thanks for that question. It is a very intense part of the book.
Thanks, Fred.
Okay, so we go to Anne and let me know if you want to get in. Okay.
Well, here's me. I'm sorry, I didn't have a chair at the table.
Oh.
Fred, I've only read great chunks of your book, which I think is fantastic.
Thank you.
And I'm really interested because I thought Peter Nicholson was a terrific cartoonist in the Australian. That's how old I am. His mother also wrote a delightful piece in a book that Bettina Arndt brought out about something or other, Mothers and Sons or something. His mother was very funny too. But you contrast the two when Bill took over from Peter, and you said, you know, Peter thought of politicians as actually human beings, and, you know, they had to lead lives, and he had a certain empathy that he didn't want to take them apart totally. But when along came Bill, they didn't just poke one another, they chopped each other's heads off and farted in each other's faces and did all that. And I love Bill's cartoons. Mm. But underneath Bill, you point out there was always anger, really strong anger, and it comes from his genes, from way back in his family. And in a sense, I thought the Aboriginal cartoon that made him, you know, the pariah, was brilliant, but also it went beyond taking the tall poppy down. It was sort of also suggesting that Aboriginal parents weren't any good. So he kind of, his anger at what was happening to children and whatever spilled over. And just how, can you just talk a bit more about how that made his art, that streak of anger?
Yes. Well, that, I mean, there's a good point that he made in the, he wrote an op-ed the next day after Righto, what's his name then? And he said, I'm going to paraphrase from memory, but it was something along the lines of, oh, sorry, let me put the context. The Righto, what's his name then, is about the Don Dale Correction Centre in Darwin. And it was exposed in Four Corners as a horrific place for kids. And Bill said in his op-ed the day after Righto, what's his name then, he said, if you think Don Dale is an awful place for children, you should see the homes some of them come from, and you wouldn't be surprised that they wind up in prison. And there is an enormous amount of anger in that sentence as in itself. I mean, the anger that Bill triggered with that cartoon was directed at him for being racist. Bill was angry that a generation of Aboriginal kids is growing up surrounded by sex abuse and degeneracy and just worse than third world conditions. And so, yeah, I mean, it's interesting that you draw that connection, Anne, because I hadn't thought about that cartoon being angry. Bill's anger in his early days was explicit. You know, people were idiots and they deserved to get their heads chopped off, or their, you know, their knives plunged into their backs, or, you know, falling off cliffs or whatever. There was almost, I mean, Ralph Steadman was an inspiration to Bill in the early years. People might know Ralph Steadman was the illustrator who accompanied Hunter S. Thompson. And he was famous for sort of splattering droplets of ink all over the paper. And Bill did it to depict, you know, sprays of blood coming from, you know, dismembered carcasses. And that was Bill in his reckless kind of, reckless years. But, yeah, you're right. Righto, what's his name then? That's angry, but it's in a much more subtle way. Yeah, Bill, you know, Bill was angry about injustice. There's another point I make in the book. Warren Brown, who's the cartoonist for the Daily Telegraph and was one of Bill's closest friends, he explained that Bill acquired the ability to be funny. He didn't think Bill was naturally funny. And Bill was... Bill learned to be funny, and in the early days, he made it funny in an angry way. But I think he later became more subtle about it. So,
His caricatures of important people are just brilliant. You don't need a word You know it's Malcolm Fraser, or you know it's John Howard, or you know it's Malcolm Turnbull. It's just, he really is an artist.
And you can only do that if you're a fine artist. There's another really good quote from one of his fellow artists at Fairfax who knew him quite well. And he said, and again, I'm paraphrasing, but he said something along the lines of, Bill could capture a person's character through what they looked like. Now, that sounds like a kind of a bland statement, but it's actually not. I mean, you know, a photograph will capture what you look like, but only a great portraitist can capture your character through what you look like. And Bill extended that into caricatures. His caricatures were just extraordinary. I think, you know, he was Australia's finest cartoonist, but Australia's finest caricaturist as well.
Thanks. Have I missed anyone? Bill had a go at me once. He had a row with Helen Demidenko over The Hand Inside the Painter. He depicted me as a Nazi, but a very small and unattractive one, which was... So we responded by inviting him to the Sydney Institute. But just on the... You mentioned the two portraits of Don Bradman. I think one of them's destroyed, is it, in a fire? So tell us this, because in a way you think, you look at that one of those portraits and think, well, you know, why didn't it win the Archibald? But tell us about his relationship with Donald Bradman.
Well, that's an interesting question. The one that was lost was a study for those two portraits, and that's the one that got lost in the fire. It was the one that Bill kept. He did a study. But the two official portraits, one is in the Bradman Museum down in Bowral, and the other one's in the National Portrait Museum in Canberra. But, that's an interesting question. Because Bill's conservatism, which was a part of his love of Australian culture, came through very early on. It's probably Paul Kelly probably saw this back in the mid-90s or recognised something of value in it. But Bill absolutely adored Don Bradman. And it's interesting, you know, Bill had no affinity with one day cricket or, you know, the modern version of the game, but he loved test cricket. He loved the ABC, you know, for broadcasting the, you know, back in the day when the ABC was the main broadcaster, and he adored Bradman. And he took his dad on the second occasion of the second portrait that he did, when he delivered it to Sir Donald down in Adelaide. He took his dad with him, and he sat back. I quote Bill. Bill wrote about it afterwards, and I quote him in the book. He sat back and listened to his dad talk to Sir Donald and I've forgotten Donald's wife's name, but the three of them sat there reminiscing about the good old days of Australia, or you know, their memories of Australia. And Bill was fascinated by it, which is, you know, I find that interesting. You know, he's such a radical sort of, you know, lefty iconoclast. But even then, he understood if you love Australia, you have to love Sir Donald, and you have to love the glory days of Australian cricket. So it's an interesting insight, and I think when his love of Sir Donald from the early 90s carries through to, you know, his relationship with John Howard later in life.
So have I missed anyone? We're about to finish. So from going from this, tell us about his relationship with Barry Humphreys. He drew, I think it's in your book, as you know, he drew Humphreys, and then Barry spoke at his memorial service. And so how did Bill and Barry get on?
Well, I mean, I don't know Barry very well. I spoke to him a few times while we were preparing for the memorial. I was given the job of liaising with Barry for the memorial and making sure he was happy with his speech and so on. Bill was, in Barry's words, Bill made Australians think and laugh at the same time, which, you know, you could use those words to describe Barry as well. I guess I've never spoken with Barry at length about Bill, but I guess that, you know, they had a common deep knowledge of European art and of seeking the truth. You know, Barry doesn't resile from the truth. He has great fun, you know, mocking and satirizing the truth. The other consistent thing in Bill, in the book about Bill, is that when he went to Europe, that's what he was seeking, was the truth, that as far as he could see it, in art and in cartooning. That's what he adhered to, and that's what got him in trouble in the end. But there's a really nice anecdote about Barry towards the end of the book, about Barry squaring up an old problem he had with Malcolm Turnbull from the 1980s, and he hadn't got the opportunity to publicly dress Malcolm down until he was speaking at Bill's memorial, and that moment was particularly delicious, I got to say.
You covered that in your book, but just very briefly, he went back to what Turnbull had said at a press conference in London when Turnbull was in London. So tell us briefly what it is.
Barry was on fire at the time. I mean, he was in London as Dame Edna and Sir Les, and he was selling out in the West End. So he was huge. And Turnbull was in the was in London at the time for something related to Spycatcher, I assume. And he was asked at a press conference what he thought of Sir Les and Dame Edna. And I guess the assembled press were expecting some sort of, you know, light-hearted, joke about his compatriot. But Turnbull said that Barry Humphries was an embarrassment to Australia. And Barry waited 40 years before he could get Malcolm back. But, oh, goodness gracious, he got him back in fine style. And Malcolm was sitting only 3 metres away. He was... you know, he was in the front row, and I was watching carefully because I knew it was coming up. I was one of the few people among the 800 who knew it was coming up. And I watched Malcolm carefully, and he shot this really intimidating look at Malcolm just before he launched into this anecdote. It was very funny.
Well, Fred, that's a nice spot on which to end. Look, thanks for an engrossing talk today, and remembering Bill Leake, who was a friend of some of us here, or probably quite a few of us here. I think your speech today, which is terrific, is an example of what the ABC is missing out on. I mean, it's not the ABC that's missing, because they've got a culture around that don't want to hear people they disagree with. But what's missing, who's missing out on this, is ABC viewers and listeners, who won't, unless the ABC attitude changes, you won't be able to hear your account of your book on Bill Leake. A leak, but at any rate, you've made it here, and we're very grateful. It was a terrific occasion, and as I said, copies are available for sale, signed by Fred, and Anne will be putting out a note about that tomorrow. But for tonight, well done, and thank you.
Thank you, Jared. Thanks for listening.
Thanks, Fred.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.